In my earlier lesson, we read a passage out of Acts chapter 17. And unlike those at West Carrollton, you don't have to wait a week to hear my next portion of this lesson. We talked about the Epicureans in verse 17, but they weren't the only group that was mentioned there in Acts 17. And after I had delivered my lesson, someone at West Carrollton had said, would I prepare something about the Stoics, which are also mentioned there? And I said, of course I would. So just to refresh ourselves, let's go back to that passage in Acts chapter 17. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting, for you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. Stoicism is a school of Hellenistic philosophy which was founded by Zeno of Citium. He also was in Athens. This was in the early 3rd century BC. Don't worry, I hadn't heard of him either. But he brought this school of thought that was a philosophy of personal ethics informed by its system of logic and its views on the natural world. According to its teachings, the path to happiness is found in accepting the moment as it presents itself. Don't allow yourself to be controlled by the desire for pleasure or fear or pain, but to use your mind to understand the world and to do one's part in nature's plan, and by working together and treating others fairly and justly. As Mike said, you know, was the Epicureans, he goes, you know, it sounded pretty good, you know, a nice peaceful lifestyle. And I said, well, you could see why it was widely accepted. Well, this is also something very, you know, easy for people to get behind. It doesn't really require much. It doesn't require any actions. Just to focus on controlling your desires and your, you know, pleasures and focus on the earth. They were known for saying that virtue is the only good. External things such as health, wealth, pleasure were not in themselves good or bad, but they did have value as material for virtue upon which you could act. The Stoics also held that certain destructive emotions were the result of errors of our judgment. They believed that people should aim to maintain a will which is in accordance with nature. Because of this, the Stoics thought that the best indication of an individual's philosophy was not what a person said, but how a person behaved. To live a good life, one had to understand the rules of the natural order of this world, since they thought everything was rooted in nature. So that with that having been said, how does this mindset align with Christianity? And where do they differ? So many points of continuity and discontinuity exist between Christianity and the Stoics. Stoicism is pantheistic. That is that the universe was in itself, in and of itself, a vast universe, intelligence, and had its own will. There were no gods. Nature in the universe was their god. It was a religious belief that, you know, was totally revolving around that thought that universe was their god and that God is all around us throughout the universe. Paul, on the other hand, taught that Christianity is focused on that there is a God who is distinct from its creation. It wasn't God was not the universe. God created the universe, but he was not the universe itself. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 5 and 6 says, For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and for whom we exist. And one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 and 16 reads, speaking about Christ here, He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by Him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through Him and by Him. The Stoics also believed in a cycle of perpetual destruction, in which the universe was destroyed by fire and then reborn, with everything occurring exactly as before. Stoics were also, as like the Epicureans were, they were also very doubtful and did not believe in the afterlife. In contrast, Paul believed that human history was moving towards a final conflict, after which there would not be a renewal and we would get to do it all over again. This would be a final conflict between God and the forces of evil. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 24 through 28 describes this. Then comes the end, when He delivers the kingdom to God the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and power. For He must reign until He has put all His enemies under His feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. For God has put all things in subjection under His feet. But when it says all things are put in subjection, it is plain that He has accepted who put all things in subjection under Him. When all things are subjected to Him, then the Son Himself will also be subjected to Him who put all things in subjection under Him, that God may be all in all. God will triumph in this final showdown of good and of evil. And 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10 reads, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, pardon me, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil." So God is going to triumph over good and evil, but then we will be subjected to the triumphant God. We will stand before Him on the day of judgment, and all humanity will be judged. So, despite other points on which Paul's teaching seems to align with Stoicism, these key differences mark the worldviews of Paul and Stoics as being fundamentally different. I found it very interesting that when I was preparing to study for this, believe it or not, I didn't really have a previous understanding of Stoicism and Epicureanism. I did have to do some research, and when I typed in Google some keywords that would help me understand how Stoicism and Christianity were different or alike, you know, to kind of get a feel for what their philosophies were. The first return in my Google search was an article that was called "We Have Become Stoic." And as it turned out, it was written by someone I knew. Glennon, you might be the only person that knew this person. And there may be others, but you probably knew Weldon Warnock. Yeah, but anyone else here may be too young to have known Weldon. He's been gone for quite some time. Weldon Warnock was the preacher at Knollwood, one of them, when I was growing up. I was telling Roger between classes, I attended Knollwood until I was 10 and have been at West Carrollton since. And just as an aside, in that 10 years I was at Knollwood, there were 5 different preachers, one of which was Weldon Warnock. In the 42 years that I've been at West Carrollton, there's been 1 preacher. So I was expecting a lot of turnover from, you know, I was used to that, and it's been quite different there at West Carrollton. But Weldon was my grandfather's best friend. And matter of fact, my grandfather had 3 wives. He was a widower twice, and on the third time that he got married, Weldon married him, and I was my grandfather's best man. And so Weldon holds a very dear place in my family's life. So this article was published in 2002, but Weldon actually died in 2009. And I went back and I found out that this article was actually written in October 1984. So 35 years or so ago, 36 years ago. And just to show that the things he was railing against then and encouraging us to do then, equally acceptable to us today. His breakdown of Stoicism, you know, that we can look at, is that he started with one of the chief characteristics of the Stoics was a word called ataraxia, A-T-A-R-A-X-I-A. It's a word that means freedom from emotions. The word Stoic itself means not easily excited, unmoved by joy or grief. The Stoics strove to master their feelings in order that they would not be affected by any one event, even personal tragedies in their lives. They kept an even keel. They presumed that peace could only be realized by total indifference or apathy toward all things. Their personalities, therefore, were cold and lifeless. If I'd gone around the room and asked everybody to write down a definition for the word Stoic, it would be almost statue-like or, you know, non-responsive, you know, just very demure and, you know, very reserved. Well, that's really what it comes from. They didn't want to have any highs or lows. They just kind of kept the same, you know, the same mindset and the same level of emotion at all times. So how can we apply this to our lives as Christians? As Brother Warnick's title was, we have become Stoic. He wasn't saying that as a compliment. And so let's look at some ways in our worship in particular that we might be too Stoic. We may have too much of this in our approach to how we worship the Lord. Having Stoic singing. We should stand and sing loudly. But more importantly, when we sing these words, we should mean these words. I've often wondered how some people sing these songs and would never ever say these words if it wasn't part of the song. The words that are included in these songs are meant to encourage us, to edify us, to build us up, to help us focus on what's important. But if you're just singing the words and not paying attention to anything that it says, then you're being too Stoic. Cody said, my talk brought to mind words in a song. He obviously is paying attention because he knew what song he wanted to sing to focus on that. It's very important that as we go through singing, that we're not just going through the motions. We need to be aware of what we're singing and that realize that, yes, we're singing to each other, but we're singing to the Lord, and we need to be aware of the words we're singing. We need to be aware and believe on the words that we are singing. Those of us who are song leaders, we have a very important part to play in this. We too could become Stoic in our song leading. At West Carrollton, we don't have a much problem here, and I don't see it a problem here, but I think we've all been to congregations where singing is almost an afterthought. It's something they know they have to do. But let's just get through it until we, you know, just get through with it, and then we'll get to the sermon that we came here to hear. But song leaders don't keep up the pace, or if they're not singing energetically, we can force others to become Stoic in their approach to it. So we need to understand that we're leading the congregation. We're leading them by the words of the songs that we choose. We aren't just people standing up here making sure we're staying in tune or staying on time. We need to lead them, so we need to focus on the words that we are singing. Another way that we could potentially become Stoic is by having Stoic prayers. I noticed both Rogers were very, you know, very thorough in the thoughts that they spoke about. It's not something that we do at West Carrollton, but I noticed that after Cody gave the announcements, he walked over to Roger Sr. and gave him the clipboard. I noticed Roger did it. That's an excellent way to make sure that you are focusing on what it is that you want to be talking about. So often, people just don't even stop and think. I think we've been in congregations, been around people that we could almost say the prayer word for word before the person even begins, because it's just cliches and phrases that they just know that's what they want to say. And so we shouldn't have a formula for our prayer. Our prayer should be focusing every time upon what's important that day, what may have been talked about, and focusing on that. Matthew chapter 6, verses 5 through 7, Jesus gives us an instruction manual. He tells us how we should pray. And when you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, that they may be seen by others. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you pray, go into your room and shut the door and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words. Focus on that last part. Empty phrases. Saying things that are just to be heard. That's a great illustration of praying that is a stoic approach to that. I try to change up my wording from time to time as I'm praying, like I mentioned, to focus on what may be important that day, what may have been focused on. And it's something we need to do in our public prayer as well as our private prayer life. And I challenge you to think about the things that you are praying about. Another way that we could have become stoic is a stoic approach towards the Lord's Supper. Our observation of the Lord's Supper is a remembrance of Christ's death. But I've not always tried to look at it as a somber occasion. You know, most memorial services are somber, sad. You'll get the occasional person that says, no, I want it to be celebration. I've been to a funeral a few years ago where the person was a big Ohio State football fan. And it was asked, everybody come wearing your Ohio State shirts or, you know, something along those lines. The viewpoint was it wasn't a sad occasion. It was something to be remembered, and remembering Paul in that way was a way that would help his family. So we should look upon the death that Christ, you know, the life he gave up when he died on the cross for us, we should look upon that as a wonderful thing. It's something about which we should definitely be thankful and grateful. It should be something that should energize us, encourage us, and give us strength. Because he gave up his life that we might live. We would have had no hope of eternal life if he had not done that. When I was, before I became engaged in the preaching, and I would lead a lot of song services, many times I would lead an upbeat song going into the Lord's Supper, because that's the approach I've always kind of felt about it. It's a celebration of us having the ability to have salvation. His death gave us hope, and it should be celebrated. I'm sure we've all been to congregations where the observation of the Lord's Supper is almost a paint-by-numbers type of event. What I mean by that is, you know, just once going through the motions. Well, they sing two songs, the men gather at the table, there's some short remarks are said, the emblems are passed around, and then the collection is taken. At West Carrollton a few years back, they actually changed up our approach towards the Lord's Supper and the communion. We do the communion first because the elders at the time thought that it was something that we wanted to make sure was distinct. And so they looked at it as they wanted to give us every chance to have a good approach towards it. We also, actually, Brad's remarks are about the length of the remarks that we do. Oftentimes, you'll go to a congregation and the person leading the table will make a few. We have the Lord's Supper. We have the bread. They mumble through a few things and then they go. I actually enjoyed what Brad's comments were before we observed the memorial. We should be led into thoughts that'll keep our minds on this memorial. We need to rededicate our minds every time the table is here so that we can remember the great sacrifice that Christ made for us and the hope that it does provide to us. And lastly, looking at ways that we could and may have become stoic is stoic preaching. For years, the man you know, who have preached in at West Carrollton. I mentioned Mike's been there for years, but you know, different times there. As right now, I'm kind of co-preaching with Mike. There have been others down through the years that have done that. For years, we would have a student from Florida College come and spend a summer with us, and they would get practice if that's what they were wanting to do, is become a sermon. And I feel I've tried to always make sure my topics are relevant and kind of interesting. And I tell you, if Epicureanism isn't, you know, on the top of everyone's, you know, list of things to talk about, I don't know what to tell you. No. I mean, but I do try to make my sermons, you know, easy to follow and to help you be engaged in them. And I do hope I meet that goal. Those of you, as I say, may have just been Glendon and Edith. That new brother Weldon, the one I mentioned, I saw this article about. I don't think he was preaching. He was teaching to himself when he said about Stoic preaching. Weldon was. He would pound on the pulpit. He would yell, and he would be very demonic. He was a pacer. He'd go from one side to the other. I'm a pretty sedentary preacher. I like staying here, but he would go to one side or the other in with elevated voices, very passionate in what he was doing. As I put here in my note, he was a pulpit pounder extraordinaire. Never seen anyone better than he was at that. No one doubted that he was passionate about what he was doing. Now, I don't pound the pulpit, and I generally don't raise my voice, but I do have passion for the lessons that I present. And I hope that when I have occasion to stand before you, you all have something that you can take from my perspective, from the perspective of my lessons. But we should always want the audience to have passion for the word. I've been to gospel meetings and so forth, and I've heard preachers that afterwards I've said this phrase. I don't like to say that the preacher entertained me, but some preachers are very engaging. You enjoy listening to them just because of their delivery. Well, I would hope that we enjoy listening to them because of the words that they're presenting to us. We should want the audience, and the audience should have passion for this word. Matthew chapter 5, verse 6 says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied." Here Jesus tells us that there are going to be people that are looking to be filled, not with food or water, but with righteousness. They thirst for it. They hunger for it. And they shall be satisfied. Now, this is a lengthy passage that I'm going to read here, but I do want to focus on it. John chapter 6. We're going to read verses 22 through 35. "On the next day, the crowd that remained on the other side of the sea saw that there had been only one boat there, and that Jesus had not entered the boat with his disciples, but that his disciples had gone away alone. Other boats from Tiberias came near the place where they had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. So when the crowd saw that Jesus was not there, nor his disciples, they themselves got into the boats and went to Capernaum, seeking Jesus. When they found him on the other side of the sea, they said to him, 'Rabbi, when did you come here?' Jesus answered them, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me, not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give to you. For on him God the Father has set his seal.' Then they said to him, 'What must we do to be doing the works of God?' Jesus answered them, 'This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent.' So they said to him, 'Then what sign do you do that we may see and believe you? What work do you perform?' 'Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat.' Jesus then said to them, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, it was not Moses who gave you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world.' They said to him, 'Sir, give us this bread always.' Jesus said to them, 'I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall not thirst.' These people had been fed as part of the feeding of the 5,000 from the loaves and the fishes. They came because they were hungry. They wanted more of that. And he lets them know, I know exactly why you're here. I'm very much aware of what it is that you want. But, you know, sometimes you'll say, you know, you don't get what you want, you get what you need. And at this point in time, Jesus tells them, you may want the physical bread, but you need the spiritual bread. Jesus and his word supplies all that we need. He is the true bread of heaven provided and given to us by God. He is the bread of life. Whoever comes to him will never hunger and will never thirst. Lately, I'd been introduced to a man who is a member of I didn't know there was such a thing, but it's the Speakers Hall of Fame, I guess, for like motivational speakers or people that, you know, deliver accounts to, you know, conventions and so forth. The gentleman's name is Steve Gilliland, and I enjoy his talks very much, and actually I've bought some of his speeches and listened to them. And one of the most popular books is called Making a Difference, A Matter of Purpose, Passion, and Pride. And he talks about it in the context of, you know, of like your careers, the jobs that you hold. And he says, you have to have passion to do your job and to do it well. But he says, if you don't have that passion to do your job and to do it well, then you owe it to your company and yourself to go and find something else to do. He's encouraging people to be passionate about the jobs that they do. And I'd like to apply that same standard to our spiritual career, for lack of a better term. So what is it that we're passionate about? Are we passionate about our salvation? Are we passionate about our worship? Spreading the gospel? If not, I don't want you to go and find something else to do, as he advises people who aren't happy in their jobs. Instead, I encourage you to rededicate yourself, because wide is the path and the gate to destruction, but narrow is where the path to salvation. It's a hard path, and you have to be encouraged. You have to be passionate to do something that goes against the nature that you have. So I encourage you to dedicate yourself or rededicate yourself, whatever the case might be. But our passion, if it is in the Word, can help us stay on that path to righteousness, no matter how hard it may be. And we can obtain our home and our crown, which is promised to us in heaven. As I did earlier today, if there's anyone here that is in need to either dedicate your life to God by being buried in baptism, or perhaps rededicate your life, and you need the prayers of those in this congregation, the opportunity to do so stands before you at this time as we stand and as we sing.